Okay, we're moving on to the lower respiratory tract. The anatomy of the lower respiratory tract starts with the trachea. The trachea goes down into the lungs, then it branches into the bronchi, and that branches into smaller bronchioles, which end in the alveoli, which are the air sacs. The air sacs and the alveoli are one cell thick, which facilitates the exchange of gases across the alveoli. So all of this constitutes the lower respiratory tract. Larynx and above is the upper respiratory tract. Okay, is the lower respiratory tract sterile? Or does it have organisms? Normal flora.
Normal flora.
Respiratory tract is sterile. Okay, there should not be any organisms in there.
Makes it easy.
The way we get organisms is aerosols, so airborne transmission. Some of these organisms colonize, as we've seen. And then that can lead to self-inoculation, which means, and we're going to explain this a little bit later, but we can swallow these organisms and get them down into our respiratory tract in some situations. Hematogenous organisms can get into the blood from somewhere else and spread to the lungs. And direct penetration isn't shown on here, but that would be like a trauma or chest injury of some sort that penetrates and allows the organisms to enter. Okay, we do have some host defense mechanisms. The epiglottal reflex, we talked about the epiglottis, so that helps close off the trachea and prevent organisms getting down there when we're eating. We have the bronchial mucus, same thing we have in the upper respiratory tract, except now it's a little bit lower. So mucus secretions there in the ciliated epithelial cells, which trap the organisms that do happen to get down there, and move them outward, the cilia moves them outward. And so some people that live in polluted areas, air pollution, or smokers, have the cilia destroyed so that they can't move that organism out. And that's why they are more prone to lower respiratory tract infections than those that have a good ciliated reflex. Of course, there's the cough reflex, propelling organisms outward. We've already seen the effects of coughing and sneezing on others. And then there are alveolar macrophages, so cells of the immune system that can help phagocytize these organisms. Okay, so the lower respiratory tract is sterile. However, in order to get a sample, the primary sample that we're talking about from the lower respiratory tract is the sputum. Sputum samples. Okay, so in order to get those up, they have to pass through the oral cavity. So they can, when we get the sample, it can be contaminated by upper respiratory organisms. It can show some organisms in there. Okay, here's sample collection. It's a sputum is a deep cough specimen. So it has to come up from a chest. It's not just saliva. Can't have that. That's not acceptable. It's got to come up from the chest. Deep cough. And we have to collect it in a sterile container looking like, these are some of them, leak-proof container, and immediate transport to the lab in 1 to 2 hours so that the organisms don't die. There are some ways, some people have trouble getting a cough. We usually want a first morning cough or a sputum sample. A couple things you can do, you can have them breathe in some, what we call nebulized air. They can breathe in some warm saline solution, and that helps loosen up things so that they can cough up a sputum sample. Sometimes massaging the back will loosen up the mucus in there. Pounding the back will get it to come loose. So there are a few things that you can do to help, but it's got to be a deep cough specimen. And usually we're not the ones that collect the sample. The nursing staff or whomever collects the sample, so they should be aware of the proper way of collecting samples. There are different types of samples that we can use if we can't get a sputum. There's bronchial brush, tracheal aspirate, open lung biopsy. We'll take a look at a couple of these so you can better see what they involve. And the media that's generally used for sputum sample, sputum throat, blood, chocolate. We're going to include a McConkie plate. So tell me about McConkie. What's it selected for? We've done it before. Did you have several weeks?
What?
Lactose.
That's the orange one that says lactose.
It's gram negative rods.
Gram negative rods. Okay, selected for gram negative rods, particularly the enterobacteriaceae. So we're going to introduce that this week because next week we're going to get into full blown enterobacteriaceae. And there's a lot of them. And a lot of media that we're going to use next week. So we're introducing the concrete at this point. It's differential. What does it tell you? What does it differentiate?
Lactose fermenters and non-fermenters.
Right, lactose fermenters and non-fermenters. So what color is a lactose fermenter?
Yellow or pink?
Pick your pick.
Pink.
Lactose fermenters are pink. Non-fermenters are colorless. Okay. So it's important that when we look at McConkie, we're looking at whether it is a lactose fermenter or a non-fermenter. Okay, here's a bronchial brush. A fiber optic tube is inserted through the nasal passage down into the lung area. It's got a little camera or tube, something, not really camera, but something that you can visualize. So that is pushed out of the container, the fiber optic tube, into the area where the abscess or the infiltrate is, and then a sample is taken. There's a brush here, and the brush is turned to get a sample, and then it's pulled back into this fiber optic tube and pulled out. So that way it avoids contamination from the upper respiratory tract. But of course, that's an invasive procedure, a little bit harder to do, but it is done on occasion. Okay, there's a transtracheal or tracheal aspirate in which a needle is inserted just below the trachea there, and that goes down. This one's not done very frequently at all because it does have some complications associated with it. It can cause bleeding. So you won't see that very often, but on rare occasions it may happen. There's also a bronchial lavage in which they'll flush the lung with water and then pick up a water supply and sample that. Okay, but the best sample is the sputum sample. Okay, now, even though we don't collect the sample, it is imperative that we, as laboratorians, evaluate the specimen quality. Okay, need to know. We have to evaluate the specimen quality. So we will do a gram stain on the purulent portion of the sputum. What's the purulent portion?
The pussy.
Something that shows kind of pussy area, bloody area. We'll look at some samples here of some sputums in a minute. So you take a swab, and you swab that area. Then run the swab around in it, and then you roll the swab onto the slide, just like you did with throat swabs. And then we scan it. Don't have to do gram stain. We scan it under low power, 10x. And we're looking for squamous epithelial cells. The ideal criteria is squamous epithelial cells less than 10, and greater than 25 white blood cells. That indicates it's a good sample. Okay, here's some sputum samples. Now, some people think sputums are the absolute worst.
They look disgusting.
Watching the patient collect it is the worst.
So some of them are bloody, and some of them might just have a little fleck of blood in there. That's the portion that you want to sample if it does have a little fleck of blood in there. Some are a little chunky. So you just roll around here, roll your swab in there. Okay, this is not acceptable. Why is it not acceptable sample? Okay, all of these are epithelial cells. Flat, round cells with a single nucleus. These are all epithelial cells, just normal flora from the oral cavity. And I don't see any really organisms in here, so this is not acceptable. This is a high quality sample. It's acceptable because all of these are PMNs. Actually, you do that.
Yeah,
I said don't do gram stain.
So we do gram stain.
We do gram stain. to visualize. Okay, so this is high quality acceptable because all of these are PMNs, and I really don't see any epithelial cells in there. Okay, this one is equivocal. There's a couple epithelial cells in here. There probably are not quite 25 white blood cells, but it's pretty good. So equivocal means they're plus or minus, you know, could be. If we look at some more fields, we might find some other fields that are more acceptable. So it's kind of borderline. So that's what we have to do, is evaluate the quality. Yes?
Is it possible that the organism could, like, cause necrosis or something so that you can have lots of epithelial cells?
Well, you should still see, you might have more epithelial cells, you should still see a lot of white blood cells. And sometimes you see the organism in there, too. Okay, the two organisms, the two new organisms that we're introducing this week. Oh, first of all, before I mention that, one thing about sample collection is if the patient wears dentures, you need to remove the dentures first. You don't want to sample cup of the denture. Okay, and the other thing is that they can use rinse their mouth with water or gargle before collection to try to minimize the normal flora that's in there. So there's a couple things that can be done to minimize that. Okay, so the two new organisms then that we're going to talk about this week are Streptomoniae and Klebsiella pneumoniae. So let's go over the characteristics of Strep pneumo. Okay, gram-positive lancet-shaped cocci in pairs. Okay, here's what Strep pneumo looks like. Gram-positive cocci, most of them are in pairs. Some of them form little short chains with a couple pairs attached together, but the predominant picture is diplococci. We call these lancet-shaped because they're more, a little bit more oblong, and they're attached end-to-end rather than the copies being shaped that we saw with the Neisseria that are attached side-to-side. Okay, so that's what we're looking for strep pneumo. Okay, they are usually almost always alpha hemolytic. What color is alpha hemolytic?
Green.
Green. Isn't that clever? I put that in green. Okay. They are small round colonies. Now, there's two types of colonies that you can see on the plate. One of them is kind of a flat, dryish looking colony, and it has an area of central depression. That's due to an autohomolysin. The organism produces an enzyme that begins to destroy the colony right in the middle, so it's got the central depression, but we've still got alpha hemolysis around there. Okay, the other colonies are mucoidy and runny. I'll show you a picture of those in just a minute. They're more mucoidy and runny together because they have capsules. And those are usually the pathogenic ones, encapsulated ones. Okay, we're going to do the Optigan test. And this is on your flow diagram. So if you get a gram-positive cocci, go back to your very first flow diagram for the gram-positive cocci, and it'll show you under alpha hemolysis the Optigan. You do not have to do a VEA and a sodium chloride first. If it's alpha hemolytic, just go right to the Optigan disc. And we need to measure this greater than 16. Now, there's a couple of different brands of Optigan that we use, and one of them says greater than 14. So I need to read the package insert of the one that we're using and see if it's 14 or 16. So we'll let you know that for sure, but you do have to measure it. Here's what the Optigan looks like. Now here's the runny mucoidy colonies. You can see how they all run together, and they look very mucoidy. Okay, so those usually have capsules and are more likely to be pathogenic organisms. Now, some people are carriers of strep pneumo. So just because you isolate a little bit of strep pneumo does not necessarily mean that that is a pathogen and the patient has pneumonia. Of course, you have to correlate the clinical symptoms and everything else. If you're culturing these and the predominant organism, so again, quantity is important. If that's the most predominant organism on your plate, you don't find another pathogen, then it's most likely that strep pneumo is a pathogen. And particularly if you see these running nucleic colonies. So the Optigan disc is also called a P disc. I suppose that stands for pneumoniae. And you do this just like you do an omoplasin or bacitracin. Get confluent growth, put the disc right in the middle, and then you measure the diameter of the disc. Okay, question.
So this streak, it doesn't look like it's streaked quadrants, it's just streaked all over there.
We'll just use a half plate, okay, like we've done, and just streak it for control growth and put the disc right in the middle. And we do that on a blood auger. Okay, there's also a test called the bile solubility test, which we are not going to do, but you can take a drop of bile and drop it right on the colonies on the plate. The problem is it kind of spreads a little bit, and when you drop it on the plate, it kills the organisms on the plate. But the bile dissolves some of the amino acid linkages in the peptidoglycan cell wall. So it dissolves the colonies. And strep pneumo are susceptible to the bile, but we are not going to do that. Some labs might, but the most common one is probably Optica. Then there's this Quellen reaction. Okay, this is a serological test, an antigen antibody test, the Quellen. And it tests for capsular swelling. It's one of the older tests. We don't do it as much anymore. Here's what Quellen reaction looks like. It reacts with capsulated organisms, so as it's not specific for strep pneumo, but it will also react with pox, influenza, and Neisseria meningitis, because those all have capsules. But what you do is you mix antiserum with the organism, equal amount, suspension of the organism and antiserum, let it sit for 5 minutes and then observe it under the microscope. And you can see the capsule here, the swelling of the capsule. Now, this looks like strep pneumo because these look like diplococci. But again, it is not specific for strep pneumo, and you have to have some practice reading these because there can be some inferences, but that's the serological test, antigen antibody analysis. Okay, our other new organism that we're doing this week is Klebsiella, Klebsiella pneumoniae. Okay, this is a member of the Enterobacteriaceae, which again, we're going to talk about in depth tomorrow, or next week. Okay, these are gram-negative rods, and most of the Enterobacteriaceae, there are a lot of them, look pretty much the same. So you can't really tell from a gram stain what it is. Some are shorter, fatter, some are longer, thinner. They're all gram-negative rods, and they are all oxidase negative. This is one of the characteristics of the Enterobacteriaceae. They're all oxidase negative, so we'll do an oxidase test for that one. It is a lactose fermenter. So what's it going to look like on math? Yeah, there's Klebsiella. Now, Klebsiella is a capsule, so it often is mucoidy and runny, and sometimes it's stringy like that. Not always. But if you see a very thin colony that looks more mucoidy, think Klebsiella, because the other common one that we see in the Enterobacteriaceae is E. coli. And E. coli is usually a flat, drier-looking colony. But it, too, is a lactose fermenter. Okay, we're going to do a test called the IMVIC. IMVIC is an acronym, and it stands for indole, methyl red. What do you think the B is? Bose-Poschauer. Methyl red and Bose-Poschauer usually go together. And citrate. The I is just inserted in there for
IC.
Just an aid in the pronunciation of IMVIC. Okay, the IMVIC was one of the earliest tests used for the identification of Enterobacteriaceae because what it was used for primarily to see if there was any fecal contamination of food or water supply. They would just do an IMVIC reaction and that would tell if there's E. coli in there, Klebsiella, or other Enterobacteriaceae. So, some labs don't do the IMVIC anymore. When we get a little bit later, we'll do something else, but we're going to do these tests. You already know how to do methyl red, Bose-Poschauer, and citrate. You don't know how to do indole yet. I'll show you that one. Okay, we've done TSI. Now, do you remember how to do a TSI? How do you do it? Stab and streak. Okay, stab clear to the bottom. It's important that you stab clear to the bottom of the tube. Stab to the bottom of the tube. Stab to the bottom of the tube. Okay, got it? Stab to the bottom, speak.
On the stabbers, what are they called?
Needles.
Plastic
needles.
Plastic ones, yeah. It starts to get wide before you get all the way down to the bottom.
Doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter if it's wider in the top.
Usually, when you work in a lab, you're going to use the wire needle, which is the same size all the way, but with ours. So it doesn't matter on this one because we're not measuring motility or anything like that. But it has to go all the way to the bottom because we have to read the reaction in the butt of the tube. And if you don't stab all the way to the bottom, then we're not going to get a change of reaction in the butt. Okay, and then the slant. Okay, how do we interpret a TSI? What does it say over 80? It means acid, but what are we reading?
Color.
What is the first A? You look at these. You read the slant over the butt. First A is the slant, the bottom is the butt. A means acid. What color is a TSI to start with, uninoculated? Red. It's red to start with. So if it ferments, it will change to yellow, and that's the acid. Now, there are three sugars in the TSI. There's glucose, lactose, and sucrose. In the butt is glucose, so it'll ferment the glucose. These are all glucose fermenters. Okay, they're all glucose fermenters. Some of them are lactose fermenters, and some are not. Klebsiella is a lactose fermenter. So we'll review this again next week with the Enterobacteriaceae. And this one produces gas. So here's the TSI. Here's the slant and the butt. You can see the very bottom. But the butts are all yellow. They are all yellow because they all ferment glucose. Glucose. Okay, so the butts are all yellow. So this is an acid slant over an acid butt. A over A. This one is a K over A. Does not ferment lactose, which is in the slant. So these will all ferment glucose first, and then if they can ferment lactose, they will go ahead and change the butt or the slant. But if they can't, they will stay red. Okay, this one is K over A with H2S, and you've seen that reaction. Now, sometimes the H2S is greatly enhanced, a lot of H2S, so that you can't even see the butt. But the butt is always yellow. Okay, so that's K over A with H2S. This one is A over A with gas. So this is a gas producer which produces some gas to push the media up. Sometimes it blows the cap off the tube. Sometimes it doesn't produce a whole lot, and all you see is maybe a little bubble or a crack in the media. That's the way you record TSIs. Okay, here's Klebsiella reaction. So it's A over A with gas. It's urea positive, though we are not going to do a urea to identify it. It is indole negative. We're going to do indole addition. We're going to do spot indole, not a tube indole. It's methyl red negative, Bose proscar positive, and citrate, what is it, positive or negative? Positive. Okay. So we're going to do spot indole. It's very much like spot oxidase. Use a little tube, a little dropper. Take your filter paper and your petri dish, put a drop of indole on, and then use a wooden applicator stick to get some of the organism and spread it around. We're looking for a turquoise color as evidence of positive. Now again, depending upon the brand of indole that we're using, I think the one that we're using says to wait for 2 minutes. So allow the reaction to go for 2 minutes before you call it positive or negative. But reject anything after 2 minutes. So again, I'll read the package insert to make sure that's correct with the one that we're using. Okay? Indole positive. All right. Now, the MRVP reaction, you don't have to memorize this, just shows you what better explain what MRVP is. It depends on the pathway by which the organism metabolizes glucose. They have certain enzymes. Glucose, we know, goes to pyruvic acid in the pathway of glycolysis. Then, in the methyl red pathway, we get mixed acid ferment. We get quite a bit of acid. pH is less than 4.4, so we add our methyl red indicator, we get a red color. If it goes that pathway. If it goes this pathway, it metabolizes some different end products. Not as acidic as methyl red, so we add different reagents. We add, anybody remember? You have it written down. You're supposed to have written it down from when we did it before, so that you can go back and look at your notes. But we add, first of all, how long do we incubate MRVP? 48 hours. You incubate 48 hours and you split it into two tubes. Okay, in one tube you add methyl red color. In the other tube you add 6 drops of alpha naphthol and 2 drops of 40% KOH. And this says air. So what do we have to do?
Yeah.
You aerate it. So you keep flipping it. Keep getting air in there. And let it sit for 30 minutes. Because it's not as strong as reaction since it's not as acidic. So aerate it. You don't have to aerate it the whole 30 minutes, but aerate it a little bit, get bubbles in there, set it in your rack, do something else, come back in a few minutes, aerate it again. So keep up the aeration. That helps it change colors. So that's kind of the difference between the MR and BP. Most organisms are either MR or BP positive, but there are some that are both. But most are usually one or the other. Okay, this just shows a comparison of the Enterobacteriaceae versus staph on sheep blood agar. Klebsiella and the others that we'll talk about next week are all big organisms on blood. They're usually kind of a grayish color, but just by looking at the plate, you can usually tell whether you've got a staph or an Enterobacteriaceae, you've got a major blood, something of that sort. So make sure you take a good look at these mixed colors. Ah. Okay.
Are you serious?
Okay, everybody awake? Wow. We've got some important stuff to talk about. Okay, diseases. The main disease that we're concerned about with lower respiratory tract infections and a sputum sample is pneumonia. Okay, there are 4 classifications of pneumonia: primary, secondary, hematogenous, and aspiration pneumonia. Okay, primary pneumonia is an infection due to a highly pathogenic microorganism that reaches the lower respiratory tract by the air passages. Secondary pneumonia is usually caused by an opportunistic pathogen. So our defenses are lowered. Maybe we've got another infection. This would be a superimposed infection because our immune system is slightly compromised. So that's more of an opportunistic. Hematogenous is a microorganism reaching the lung by the bloodstream. So it could be an infection somewhere else, gets into the blood, and travels to the lung. And for that reason, we often get blood cultures along with the sputum because you can detect the organism in the blood in about 30% of cases, and sometimes that's helpful, where you can't always detect it in the sputum sample. Aspiration pneumonia is when we swallow our saliva, and so the normal flora get down into the lung and can cause infection. That doesn't usually occur with a normal person with normal health and immune system, but usually if it's maybe somebody, a chronic alcoholic or somebody that's chronically ill, they've got a feeding tube down there that causes them to choke or swallow a little bit. Elderly people perhaps have a little difficulty. So that's what aspiration pneumonia is. In fact, if elderly people get pneumonia, that's not usually a good sign because oftentimes they won't recover.
So this is the regular pneumonia that people get?
Yes. There are 4 different ways, 4 different types of pneumonia. Yeah. Okay, let's take a look at the pathogens then that we're concerned about with a sputum sample to aid the diagnosis of pneumonia. Strep pneumoniae causes 80%, and this is community acquired pneumonia. This would be pneumonia that is acquired out in the community, not hospital acquired pneumonia. Klebsiella pneumoniae is on there. It's not real common, but it can occur primarily in people who are compromised, like chronic alcoholics. And it causes a more severe type because it does cause more necrosis of the lung area, and you tend to get more of a bloody sputum with Klebsiella. Strep viridans, Staph aureus, these can be normal flora, so they can be an opportunistic pathogen causing a secondary pneumonia, or they could cause an aspiration pneumonia. Pseudomonas, we're going to talk about later. That one is frequently found in patients with cystic fibrosis. Talk about that more. And then there's Haemophilus influenzae, usually occurring in children less than 6 or greater than 60. Now, is that elderly? What do you think is elderly?
Depends.
Depends on what?
How old I am.
How old you are. Still elderly? Okay, this is not, I would not say this is elder.
Upwards of 80.
Upwards of 80 might be elderly. So anyway, greater than 60 years is when you usually see Haemophilus influenzae. Okay, now, special type, Legionella pneumophila. Causes Legionnaires' disease. Who's heard of Legionnaires' disease? You all heard of it? Okay. Oh, first of all, before we get into that, let's just go through the clinical course of pneumonia. Okay, the doc has to first decide.
Everyone's coughing.
Everybody's coughing, yeah. Patient comes into the doc or coughing. The doc has to first decide, do they have pneumonia? So a lot of the clinical symptoms are very helpful in diagnosing. First of all, to be pneumonia, they're going to get a chest x-ray, and they have to see an infiltrate of some sort in the chest. An infiltrate is often just an accumulation of fluid in one of the lungs of one of the lobes of the lung. Sometimes it's a focal infiltrate. It's got organisms in it. But if there's no infiltrate present, then it's probably just a bronchitis type of infection, whose symptoms are very similar. In fact, pneumonia often starts out with upper respiratory tract infections, and then it might spread down into the lower lung. Okay, then we do a sputum. Okay, we get a sputum sample, and we are going to evaluate it for the quality of the specimen, as well as look for any microorganisms that we might see there. Okay, frank purulence suggests bacterial infection. Up to 30-50% of pneumonias are bacterial. But some can also be viral or other things that we'll take a look at here in a minute. Okay, let's go on to other symptoms. This shows the upper respiratory symptoms beginning first. Then, once pneumonia is present, expect fever, chills. What's dyspnea? Difficulty breathing, rapid breathing. Because of the fluid in the lung, it's difficult to get the air in there and get the air exchanged across the alveoli. This chills, have you heard of the word rigors? Anybody know what rigors is?
Yeah.
What's rigors?
It's just like where your muscles tense
up. Kind of, yeah. I just describe it as a bone-rattling, teeth-chattering chill. So it's really a profound chill where you're shaking. That's rigors. So that usually is the type of chill, and it's pretty high fever as well. Cough, and this is what we call a productive cough. Coughing up sputum is a productive cough, as opposed to an unproductive cough. Okay, and then they just listen to the chest for various signs. Ronchi and Rawls, whistling sound, kind of a rattling sound in the ribs.
How often do they do sputum samples? Because, I mean, I've done it like four times and they've never done one.
In the lab, we only want one sputum sample per 24 hours. So we don't want to be inundated with three or four sputum samples from the same patient in the same day. It doesn't really help. And they may not do sputum. If did they do a chest x-ray? Okay, so they maybe did not see any infiltrate.
But usually it's pneumonia. So I've been like hospitalized for even a couple times, but usually they just do the chest x-rays and I'm like, oh, you have pneumonia, and they're either like, fine, here's some stuff to take, or they are like, you're going to be in the hospital for a little while. But I've never done this sputum sample.
Well, not all docs do. It's up to them what they want to do. But based on your age and symptoms, they probably pretty much know the type of organism it is or the type of antibiotic that's going to fight it. So they just dispense with the sputum sample.
That was my question. Was like, if the x-ray diagnoses it, it's not for diagnosis purposes. It's for getting you an antibiotic that's going to kick it. Right?
That's part of it. Part of it's diagnosis, too. Because if they don't see the infiltrate, then it's probably not an pneumonia. It's a tracheal. It's a bronchitis.
Bronchitis.
But, and you can still benefit from antibiotic in the event that it's a bacteria, which the majority of them are, but there's still some that are viral. Okay, this is a blood culture. And again, as I said, 30% of patients will have pneumonia or will have organisms in the blood and that will facilitate the diagnosis. So you can see the strep pneumo, leukococci, lancet shaped leukococci in there. That's a very good smear off the blood to see those organisms in there.
That's a lot, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good infection. Okay, there are some predispositions. So influenza, obviously, will predispose to pneumonia, so you would get a secondary type of pneumonia. But the one I want to point out here is Klebsiella, often associated with alcoholism. So a patient is usually more debilitated to get a Klebsiella organism in there. And it can cause necrosis. It's more virulent, so you tend to get more of the bleeding type of a sputum with Klebsiella. Okay, let's now go on to Legionnaire's disease then. Legionella pneumophila. These are gram-negative organisms. However, they don't stain very well to gram stain. But they're long, pointy organisms, long gram-negative rods. This disease, called Legionnaire's disease, first occurred back in 1976 when there was a group of, and these are usually older gentlemen, I won't say elderly, but older gentlemen that are Legionnaires, and they met at a convention in Philadelphia. They all stayed at the same hotel in Philadelphia. And many of them came down with this type of pneumonia, a much higher fever, and it often has gastrointestinal symptoms along with it, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, which is not typical of regular pneumonia. And they couldn't find out. It took them a while to figure out what was going on, what was it, because it does not grow. It stains very faintly, gram stain. It fails to grow on routine culture media, so it doesn't grow on chocolate or blood or mass. So it was first hard to find it, figure out what it was. But eventually they came up with a media, BCYE, need to know, BCYE. This is when you can fill in on your chart. I hope you're all filling in your charts of organisms and things. Okay, this media contains L-cysteine and ferric salt, so the organism requires L-cysteine and ferric salt. How they came up with that combination, again, I don't know how they do that, but that's what buffered charcoal yeast extract is for. So then they can culture the Legionella. But the other thing I want you to remember about Legionella is that we can do serologic testing for it. So we can do a direct fluorescent antibody test, or this is a more of a chronic disease. It's a longer time period than is regular pneumonia. So they can do an acute and convalescent sera. Do you remember acute and convalescent sera? Fourfold change in antibody titer. So this is one of those tests, one of those organisms that can do that. The other thing about Legionella is it is an aquatic organism, meaning it is associated with bodies of water. And that's what happened was they found it in the water for the air conditioning system in the hotel. So when the air conditioning would come on, it would just spew forth these organisms into the air, and that's how people were inhaling them and getting sick. So it's usually not a person-to-person transmission, but they're found in bodies of water. Okay, we don't really need to know all of this stuff about Legionella, just those things that I've told you. Okay, the other atypical one is Mycoplasma pneumoniae. What's unusual about Mycoplasma? Anybody studied Mycoplasma? Mycoplasma is the smallest free-living organism. It does not have a cell wall. Does not have a cell wall, but it is a free-living microorganism. It is a bacteria organism, and it causes a disease known as primary atypical pneumonia, PAP, or we often call it walking pneumonia. And it usually occurs in people under 30, so that would be your age group, excluding Bill. and we call it atypical pneumonia because this organism does not grow on media without the cell wall. We don't see typical growth patterns. So sometimes it's confused with a viral pneumonia because that doesn't grow either. But it is treatable with tetracycline. Why cannot we treat it with penicillin? It doesn't have cell wall. Okay, so that's another reason is it's not treated by penicillin, which many of these other organisms are. But it is treated by tetracycline.
How does respiration work then? Because I thought most bacteria respirated using like their cell wall. Isn't it kind of like a modified?
Well, in the body, it harbors itself. It colonizes very close association to our own cells. So it's in association with us. It's not intracellular, but it's right there close to our cells. That's how it lives. But it is free living. It doesn't need the cell wall to do that. Another test we can do to isolate this is co-lutens, which Bill's going to tell you all about. In blood bank, we talked about this oldies last semester.
Co-lutens?
What? It can occur in some patients with Raynaud's syndrome. Cold-agglutinin is just a non-specific test. Okay, it's not specific for microbiome, it occurs in a lot of things. But what happens is the organism induces the synthesis of antigens on the red blood cells, called big I antigen. Okay, big I antigen on the red blood cell. What we do is then take a 1% suspension of red blood cells, we take the patient's serum, supposedly containing antibodies to mycoplasma, incubate that with the red blood cells, add it to the red blood cells, incubate in the refrigerator, cold, 4 degrees, overnight, and then we look for agglutinated red blood cells. If we see agglutination, we take that tube, and we then put it in a 37-degree water bath. If the agglutinate dissolves, then it is not... Or then it is a cold agglutinin because it dissolves in the warmth, in 37 degrees. If it does not dissolve, then it's not a cold agglutinin because it will agglutinate in either the cold or the warmth. So that's just a rough screening test for mycoplasma pneumoniae. It's not specific, and it's found in other situations as well.
So I remember as a kid getting walking pneumonia, and then like 2 weeks later I was in the hospital. So I don't understand, like, is it supposed to be like not severe or something, or...
It can worsen. Usually we call it walking pneumonia because people hack and cough and don't feel good, but they're still able to walk around and do what they need to do. But it could get worse. You could have had a superimposed infection.
Yeah, like does that mean if I got in the hospital and I'm not sure if it was still considered that, but it's like I never got over that part. But they told me I had walking pneumonia. So you can get that and then get, like, strep pneumonia or something else?
It's possible, yeah. It's not real common, but it's possible. Or it might not even be strep pneumonia. It could be a secondary opportunistic pathogen, staph, or something like that. Okay, so viral pneumonia, so bacterial pneumonia, 30 to 50% of our pneumonia cases are bacterial, but 15 to 30% can be viral, which again might have the same symptoms, but they're not going to grow, they're not going to respond to treatment. Other lower respiratory tract diseases would be influenza, which we're not going to talk about. We are going to come back later and talk about this fungal infection, coccidioidomycosis and histoplasmosis, but we won't do that now. And we are going to talk about tuberculosis. On Wednesday, we're going to talk about the organism, Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And then later, we'll talk about the tuberculosis. So there are other lower respiratory tract infections besides ammonia, but that's the main one that we get stool samples for. Okay, well, what are we going to do in the lab today? This week? We're going to have two knowns, Klebsiella and Streptococcus pneumoniae. So one of you still going to do the pairs, one of you will do Kleb, and one of you will do Strep. Streak it on blood, chocolate, and MAC, and do a gram stain. Make sure you look at each other's results so that you can see what these things look like. For your unknown, it's going to be a sputum sample. Streak it on blood, chocolate, MAC, and do a preliminary gram stain on your unknown.
So in our sputum sample, it could be more than just those two notes.
Absolutely. Anything is fair game. Anything that we talked about, any of the gram-positive cocci, the Neisseria, the Haemophilus, the Laxella, anything last week, and then these two new ones.
So can we do an MTM on our unknown?
Nope, we're not doing an MTM this week.
We said it was the things.
Well, can't we isolate MTM or Neisseria on chocolate?
Well, what if we have our unknown is one of the last weeks?
Yeah, we still have unknown on chocolate. Okay, so we should be able to.
It'll be consistent with the sputum sample, though, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, then I have brought two sputum samples from the hospital. They're hard to get, so I have two of them. They don't have a whole lot in them, but I want you to look at the sputum samples so you can appreciate how sticky they are. And then I want you to take a swab and swab just one of them, one or the other, not both of them. Just swab it, make a Gram stain, and evaluate it. What are we going to evaluate for?
Status.
The criteria, we'll look at the criteria. So just look at squamous epithelial cells and white blood cells. We're not going to try to look for organisms because these have been hanging around for a few days, so we might not see organisms in there. We're not going to culture it or anything, we're just going to look at it. I want you to have the experience of doing a sputum. Okay, so take your pick, one or the other. Okay, you have this chart in here, which is kind of a summary of the organisms that we've talked about so far. What they grow on, what their characteristics are, whether they grow on MAC or not, what the Gram stain reaction is. This is just a very modified steampy flow diagram, but it shows you what we're going to do for Klebsiella. Gram negative rod, oxidase negative. We're going to do the TSI. That's the first thing you do is the TSI. And then we're going to do the invite. Now, I put Pseudomonas in here. We do not have Pseudomonas this week, I'll tell you that. But a Pseudomonas will look very much similar, Gram negative broad, but it is oxidase positive, so the oxidase helps differentiate those. And that's a possibility later for, as we've seen, for particularly in cystic fibrosis patients, it's possible to have a Pseudomonas in there, but we'll talk about those in a couple weeks. So that's what you do for Klebsiella. If you've got any Gram positive cocci, go back to your first flow diagram, but remember we're incorporating optic in this. If you have alpha hemolysis that looks like strep pneumo, don't do the bioestimate and sodium chloride, just do the optical. And here's your chocolate for your Neisseria or your Haemophilus. So go back to last week's flow diagram for that because this is just a skimpy form. And I think that's it. Now, I have some, I have a bunch of cookies left over. We had a fireside last night, and there's cookies left over, so I put them in on a cart outside the lab. So, eat cookies.